ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the Third Foot, your monthly bonus episode, courtesy of our kind donors on patreon.com. It seemed like there could only be one possible topic for this month's Third Foot. In light of the seemingly abortive attempt of 12 of the richest football clubs in the world to become even richer by founding the European Super League, I've done a little dive into the world of terrible sporting money-making ideas.
Amazing. I'm so excited for this. It felt like on Sunday night that the entire footballing edifice that I have grown to know and love, then really hate, then absolutely despair for, was both tumbling around us whilst everyone was thinking, "This is terrible, but do fetch the popcorn."
It's been very interesting to watch people go, capitalism is terrible, but just in this one specific way, and we will leave everything else alone.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a little bit too much smug. Hey, football fans, enjoying that capitalist cake that you're eating from. Like, we know what's
We
happened
know.
to our
Oh, we
sport,
know.
but this was the difference between the current iteration of the Tory party and actual Nazis. That felt like the what had metastasized. Is that how you say that word?
Metastasized,
Yeah, it's one of those words that's easy to start and difficult to stop, much like what it refers to. There's so many things with this. I don't really know where to start. What I particularly love is the fact that Jose Mourinho will be the only manager in history to be sacked from a Super League club. That's quite nice. And also that Manchester United are the only team to have competed in the Champions League, the Europa League, and the European Super League in the same season.
It's quite some feat. Yeah, I feel like because we've already done an episode on worst sports club owners. I feel like we've got 12 new entrants into that catalogue this week.
Damn right. And I appreciate we've got a nice global audience. I think most of you will be on board with what's happened, but with the greatest of respect to our American listeners, if you're wondering what happened, is that a bunch of international owners, some of whom were American, attempted to Americanify European football by getting rid of promotion and relegation and forgetting that what was involved here was not brands or franchises, but sporting community clubs with a heritage going back 150 years.
Yeah, they tried to set up a breakaway league involving clubs from Britain and Spain and Italy, just for 12 of them, with a couple of others joining, and five others on an invite basis each year. With the 12 founder members all being permanent members, they could not possibly ever be removed. They would always be getting guaranteed income every year, and yet they still tried to convince everyone in their statement about it that somehow the money would trickle down to the grassroots of football and benefit everybody.
Yes, I like that it's at this point that people go, trickle-down economics is bullshit, but we're not going to do anything about it in all of the other areas of society.
Our friends at the Absolute Worldie podcast, Kyle and Joel, have done a 45-minute long episode about the European Super League. I recommend people can go check that out if you want to know more about it. Spoiler alert, 9 of the 12 original clubs have already pulled out of it because of fan fury and backlash. So it seems like it was a short, very torrid affair that is going to end in absolutely nothing happening whatsoever.
And wouldn't you know it, just one last thing on it, virtually all of the clubs are hundreds of millions of pounds in debt. So they may be some of the most successful clubs in the world with some of the most talented and expensive players, and yet some of them are upwards of £1 billion in debt. How's that late stage capitalism working out for you guys? I could also recommend, as well as our pals, the Football Ramble, which doesn't need our help, but former guest Jim Campbell, they've had a series of excellent episodes on it, and also the Stadio podcast as well, if you want all sorts of different takes on this, which don't revel in its awfulness, which is what we're going to do now.
Yes. So I had a little look at terrible sporting ideas, either from sports administrators or from clubs, or indeed from brands trying to grow themselves by aligning themselves with sports people. First of all, I thought I'd, exhume the body of Sepp Blatter, the former president of FIFA, and find some of the terrible ideas he suggested.
Is Sepp Blatter still alive?
I don't know, but I mean, he looks like he's been dead since about 1997, doesn't he?
He does. I sort of feel like Sepp Blatter is currently living with Pope Benedict somewhere in a mountain hideaway.
That's a film I want to see. Sepp and Benny.
solid pizzas coming out there.
Well, when he was, he's obviously, Sepp Blatter was a very influential figure in FIFA for many decades. Ahead of the 1994 World Cup in the United States, he suggested potentially splitting the game of football into four quarters rather than two halves, so that there could be more time for American television networks to advertise, American TV being more laden with adverts than a lot of European television channels. And there was even suggestion that they would make football matches more exciting, so there would be more goals by making the goals larger. He wanted the goals 50 centimeters wider and an extra 25 centimeters higher. An article I read about this pointed out that the fact that goals aren't overly common make them more special when you consider how little a basketball hoop being scored is celebrated in basketball by comparison.
That's it. I don't want to besmirch the fine sport of basketball, which is my favourite American sport, but I watched a Twitter video that someone put up about a particularly amazing slam dunk, and the commentators being genuinely and passionately excited by what had happened, and all I could think was, yep, that's another slam dunk.
Yeah.
and I appreciate that that's my equivalent of someone going, oh, someone put the round thing in the square thing, as people, or rectangular thing, as they always do about our sport, but it's the variety of football that makes it so good.
Yeah. He also managed to piss off pretty much every woman on the planet, but particularly football-playing ladies, by suggesting that they could increase the popularity of women's football if they wore tighter shorts and promoted a more female aesthetic. Describing in quite some detail of how if they played in more feminine clothes like they did in volleyball, it would help grow the game. In volleyball, obviously, ladies playing quite tight shorts. In beach volleyball, there's a maximum size of bikini that is permitted when playing beach volleyball.
Are there good sporting reasons for this, or are the beach volleyball's authorities just a bunch of pervs?
I would imagine the latter.
I would be all for men's football having a maximum size of shirt and shorts, and just to see Jordan Henderson running around in skimpy underwear.
Don't. You'll get me all excited.
Oh, yeah.
Sepp also decided to ban international football matches being played at higher than 2,500 metres above sea level. There were some scientific claims that playing at this altitude was bad for the health. But there were more numerous scientific claims saying this was absolutely not the case.
But isn't it the case that Bolivia have a ridiculously good home record because their stadium is so far up in the Andes?
Bolivia is very much the highest up stadium in the world. In fact, this initial law prevented Bolivia, Ecuador and Colombia from playing in their own capital cities, and Mexico and Peru's stadiums, which are not in their capital cities, were also not available. All the South American football federations, except for Brazil, basically said they were going to ignore this and they would continue playing at whatever stadium they wanted. In 2007, the limit was increased from 2,500 to 3,000, meaning only Bolivia was affected by the rule now. And all the South American federations basically again complained on Bolivia's behalf, and a year later the law was completely suspended. But my favourite Sepp Blatter moment is during the 1994 World Cup draw, they had various celebrities, and I use the word advisedly, drawing out the different balls with the team's numbers on them as they were assigning teams to the different groups for the final stage. But the one celebrity who really stood out was Robin Williams was there, and you invite Robin Williams on stage with a sporting administrator whose surname is Blatter.
Oh, no.
Mr. Blatter, nice to meet you after feeding you all these years. Are you full? Now is time to pull the blue balls. Just some examples of Robin's shtick. He put on some latex gloves for pulling out the balls from the bowl. And he said, thank you, Mr. Blatter. Funny, I met you just in the men's room a moment ago. And while Sepp is trying to do all of his admin chat, Robin is just gurning and making funny faces to the audience and completely upstaging him. And when Sepp eventually asks him to draw, he says, Robin reaches into the bowl and goes, if you'll turn your head to the side and cough. It is 7 minutes of absolute anarchy, and I love it.
I mean, why in Britain did we never get Spike Milligan to do the FA Cup third round draw?
Oh, man. Then I looked beyond Sepp Blatter and found some other examples of bad sporting ideas. France, they were beating Kuwait at the 1982 World Cup Finals 3-1, and Alain Gervais scored a fourth goal, which was very contentious. And the referee, Miroslav Stupar of the Soviet Union, awarded the goal. And the Kuwaiti bench, and indeed entire executive team who were with them, all invaded the pitch. They claimed a whistle had been blown, that the goal shouldn't have been allowed to stand. The Kuwaiti team walked off the pitch. Then the Kuwaiti president persuaded them to walk back on again. And the referee changed his mind and scratched off the goal for maybe the only time in history before
VAR. I now have a lot more sympathy with Saddam Hussein in 1991 now.
France scored another goal and Kuwait were fined £6,500. And still lost the match, obviously. But I just like the idea of a footballing referee changing a decision. A similar era, McDonald's, the 1984 Olympic Games in Los Angeles. McDonald's really wanted to do a big tie-in. And so they had a promotion. When the US wins, you win. The US won a medal. Customers could get free Big Macs, fries and a soft drink. Unfortunately, you might remember the 1980 Olympics, the US had boycotted the Soviet Union. And so when it came for the US to host 4 years later, the Eastern Bloc countries boycotted LA. Mm-hmm. Meaning the US won a lot of medals. Customers won pretty much something every single sport. And people would cash in they had these little game pieces and you cash them in for free burgers and you would then get more game pieces with more free stuff. So all of this like stuff that they were manufacturing just became a self-fulfilling industry. McDonald's, obviously a massive corporation, didn't suffer massively, but I still enjoy the idea that there was someone in marketing who came up with a scheme who had a knock on the door from one of the bosses going, you may have to take some gardening leave for a while.
He had a knock on the door from Ronald McDonald just tapping a baseball bat in his palm. What I particularly love about that is that an event, the Olympics, that is committed to making people going faster, higher, stronger, better, harder, stronger, yeah, fitter, better, higher, probably contributed more to a growth in American obesity in 1984 than anything else.
Absolutely. 2010, LeBron James was deciding on the future of his career, whether he would stay in Cleveland or join the Miami Heat. And he did leave, and obviously that was a big decision, and that would alienate a lot of his fans from his native Ohio. He made the decision during an hour-long television program on ESPN called The Decision. Yeah.
What?
He was obviously offered a lot of money by ESPN to make a decision live on air about where he would, you know, go on and continue playing basketball. He's the biggest name in basketball. It was a huge, it was like deciding where Ronaldo would go in football or anything like that. He decided to X-Factorify his career move.
In my mind, I imagine it being like the Oxford debating union, where people put forward the cases for and against Kobe doing this, and he sat on a throne while the cases were made before him, and then he declared which side he'd be coming down on at the end.
This house believes that LeBron should move to the Heat.
Yes.
Yeah. No, he didn't even tell any of his coaches, his teammates, any fans, anybody that it was going to happen until the promo started appearing. He later on said that he should have handled things differently, which I think is putting it lightly. Mm-hmm. Umbro, big name in sports clothing and equipment, they once named a shoe Zyklon.
Oh dear, that is a poor name for a shoe.
Is a really poor name, yeah.
For those with not a firm grasp on history or who are not Jew crew like myself, Zyklon is the name of the gas that was used in the chambers at concentration camps during the war. I mean, to be fair to them, it does have a sort of a superhero-y name to it. If without context.
Without context. If separate from anything, you go, that is a, like, it's the sound of a death ray. Or
I mean, that cool... doesn't really...
Oh, hang on. Okay, not made it any better. I've decided that without context, it's still terrible.
Yeah.
An Umbro spokesperson said, "We regret that there are people who are offended by the name," which is a hugely non-apology.
There are certain situations where I understand where people might try and deploy the non-apology apology, but this is not one of them.
Yeah, they went on to say the naming of the shoe was purely coincidental, was not intended to communicate any connotations. They did later drop the line of shoes altogether, but I would say not quickly enough. Reebok, also a shoe and sports clothing manufacturers. They were struggling in the early 90s. Adidas were obviously cornering the market, and the Nike were growing as well. So Reebok came up with the idea that they were going to run a massive campaign leading up to the 1992 Olympic Games in Barcelona, centered around Dan and Dave. Dan O'Brien and Dave Johnson, both decathletes who are, you know, the absolute superheroes of athletics. Mm-hmm. And Reebok decided to pit them against one another in a competition style advertising campaign over the course of several months. We played out in print and broadcast media, and so America would get to watch the men grow and train. They would use home movies of them from when they were children, and they'd see them, you know, preparing for the Olympics and qualifying and going to Barcelona, and which of them was going to win the gold medal. And it began with television commercials aired during the Super Bowl in January 1992, the most expensive slots on TV possible. Although they were both rivals, it was thought that one of them was going to win the medal. It's like Cohen Ovette in British athletics history, yeah. That sort of thing. And so the television adverts ran with the line, who will be the world's greatest athlete, Dan or Dave, to be settled this summer in Barcelona. 5 weeks before the games began, there was the American Olympic team qualifications championships, and Dan O'Brien failed three times to clear his entry height in the pole vault of 15 feet 9 inches. And in America, like, if you don't hit the qualifying height, there's no second chances. You do not make the Olympic team. So O'Brien did not even make it to the Olympics. Dave went to the Olympics and injured a foot, but did win a bronze, didn't win the gold medal. But Reebok modified their TV spots, and this is the worst bit of all, modified their TV spots to feature Dan cheering Dave on in the preparation for the Olympics.
Oh, no!
Poor Dan.
Oh, mate. Oh, that's genuinely heartbreaking.
It's awful. It's so terrible. He must have been wrapped into a contract and couldn't get out of it, because I cannot fathom him continuing going ahead with otherwise.
Well, also just thinking, can you cheer through gritted teeth? This decathlete proves otherwise.
Yes, he's the world's greatest athlete because he can cheer through gritted teeth. TV obviously has brought in a lot of innovations into the world of sport, and Fox were covering the NHL season in 1996, and they brought along the Glow Puck, or the Techno Puck. What was going to make it easier to watch ice hockey? They had done some market research, which is never a good opening sentence, and decided that the average hockey viewer, who wasn't necessarily aficionado, people who would watch, you know, the All-Star games and things like that, but not watch religiously, had difficulty following the puck on the ice and spotting it. Mm-hmm. And so executives at Fox decided they were going to make a puck that glowed blue. And so they did that, but not only did they do that, the puck had to be identical, obviously, to a regular NHL puck. It had to have a circuit board, a battery, and infrared transmitters. And when it was slapped or dropped for the first time, it would begin pulsing, and 10 cameras around the arena would detect it. And then they'd be sent to a huge truck outside, and the glue blow would be added in on the TV signal afterwards. It was a massive, expensive production for this puck to send signals to sensors, to cameras, to a van to be added to blue. But not only that, they went, oh, we can do this cool stuff with graphics. Why don't we make the puck have a red shooting star tail when it travels over 70 miles an hour? Which, obviously, anyone who just wanted to watch the fucking game was like, that is the most irritating thing I've ever seen.
This is also clearly men in their 40s and 50s. You've gone, we've heard about computer games and youth culture.
Yeah.
This is clearly what they want.
Yeah, apparently some casual fans said they liked it to help them follow the game, but it didn't really work. And players complained that the pucks didn't have the same feel as the actual regulation pucks. It only made occasional appearances and made its final appearance in 1998. Another TV blunder. In 1968, in November, the New York Jets were leading the Oakland Raiders 32-29 in American football. This is only just over a minute left to play. And obviously, being in America, there was an obligatory commercial with a minute left in play. Everyone's waiting for the match to come back. But a made-for-TV premiere of Heidi, starring Jennifer Edwards as the pigtailed goatherd, was scheduled to start on the dot at a certain time that afternoon, and God damn it, they weren't going to miss that opportunity. So when the advert ended, the match didn't come back. People who were football fans were sitting there with their beer and their chips, and the advert ended, and high on a hill stood a lonely little goat herd instead. meanwhile, the Raiders score 2 touchdowns in the remaining minute to win. What an exciting ending to a match that would have been to watch. Alcohol obviously has played many a part in sporting promotions and sporting innovations. In 1974, the Cleveland Indians were running a promotion at the Municipal Stadium, and they ran a promotion during one of the matches called 10 Cent Beer Night. It does exactly what it says in the tin. They were selling cups of beer at 10 cent a pop. More than 60,000 cups were sold, leading to a drunken melee involving, and I quote, rampant streaking, fireworks, and the riot police.
Wow. I mean, rampant streaking is what I would have on my heraldic coat of arms.
Yeah. Not only that, but fans and players from both the Cleveland Indians and the Texas Rangers, who they were playing, became engaged in a brawl before they had to be separated by the police. I think the match was abandoned at the end of it all.
Sorry, I just have to say, I really enjoy the phraseology of become engaged in a brawl. Just those words don't seem to match up. Just a guy with a bloodied head and half a broken bottle. It's going, where are you off to? I'm terribly sorry, I have an engagement.
Yeah. I've got a man to see about a punch in the face.
Yes.
But if you're looking for sporting disasters and terrible money-making ideas, you can do a lot worse than look at the White Sox. This is Chicago. Mm-hmm. Behind many of these ideas seems to be Bill Veeck, who was the owner of the White Sox at the time and a very tireless pursuer of money.
I would love to read that line in someone's obituary.
Tireless pursuer of money. He found any opportunity he could, basically, to try and innovate, draw attention, get some extra cash in. He would do it. In 1976, he had an idea for the White Sox, who were a baseball team, to play in shorts rather than the traditional pants that baseball players wear.
Had he been talking to Sepp Blatter?
Yes, almost certainly. The uniforms first appeared on August the 8th, 1976, in a match against the Royals, and the White Sox strode out wearing their shorts. And I think they could probably hear the snickering from word one. After a few innings, they realised something that should have been quite obvious. In a game that requires a lot of sliding...
Oh, no!
Yes! Wearing these short shorts against base runners who wear metal spikes. Yeah, it's not so much fun when the shins are exposed. It's a summery sport. It's not necessarily comfortable to play baseball in long clothes, but the shorts were not the solution that the White Sox thought they might be. Not only that, the Royals taunted and sledged the White Sox relentlessly. John Mabry quipped that the Sox were the sweetest team we've seen yet.
That is perfectly pitched sledging. Not a curse word in sight, but you know you've got them over a barrel with it.
Absolutely bang to rights. The White Sox did actually win the game, but it was a doubleheader. And for the second match, they switched back to their pants. The shorts only made one more appearance that season. The White Sox have also in the past sold ponchos, rain ponchos in the ballpark. Sometimes it rains during a match. People like to be able to cover up, but they're sitting out in a stand which can be exposed. Rain ponchos, great idea. The White Sox, obviously white being their colour, decided to colour their ponchos white. Anyone who has worn a rain poncho will tell you that the hood has a habit of sort of spiking a little bit when you pull it up over your head. So essentially, the White Sox were handing out free Ku Klux Klan uniforms.
Oh my God. So the sweetest team in the major league was supported by
David Duke and co. Yes.
Yeah, good Lord.
But maybe the most infamous attempt at garnering attention by the White Sox was in 1979 on Thursday, July the 12th. And this was Disco Demolition Night, which has gone down in infamy. So this is at Comiskey Park in Chicago. And essentially, the Chicago White Sox were going to play against the Detroit Tigers. And they decided that at halftime, a crate filled with disco records would be blown up on the pitch between the... It was another one of these doubleheader matches, two matches played back-to-back. In between both of them, they were going to explode a box full of vinyl records of disco.
What did they have against disco?
Well, Ben, in the 70s, obviously disco, and particularly dance-oriented disco, was the most popular music genre at the time. It was, you know, Saturday Night Fever had been a huge hit in 1977, but it sparked a bit of a backlash. Rock music fans were particularly opposed. A lot of people writing about disco at the time, there was a lot of, you know, basically homophobia and racism behind it.
I was just about to say the buzzwords. Yeah,
there's a lot of emphasis in disco on, at the time, certainly, on personal appearance and style of dress, and people thought it was very effeminate. There was a lot of gay culture had embraced disco very openly. Gillian Frank, who's a historian, wrote, by the time of the disco demolition in Comiskey Park, the media cultivated a widespread perception that disco was taking over, and disco albums dominated the Grammy Awards in 1979. And the White Sox themselves had had a disco night in Comiskey Park in 1977. So, you know, they had leaned into it. Its roots in both black culture and gay culture had turned rock fans, and predominantly white heterosexual males in particular, against disco. So the White Sox had heard a Chicago DJ and anti-disco campaigner, Steve Dahl, talking about how he wished he could blow up some disco records. And so they invited him to do like a link up. They contacted his radio station, 97.9 WLUP. And because their number is 97.9, admission to the stadium was discounted to 98 cents. And people were encouraged to bring along their vinyl records. White Sox hadn't been doing well in attendance. They'd been getting about, you know, 15,000 people in a match. They were hoping for maybe 20,000. 5,000 more people would be great. At least 50,000 people showed up, packing the stadium. Thousands more continued to sneak in after the gates were closed, because Dahl was very widely listened to, and he had encouraged as many people as possible to show up. Lots of the records, which were meant to be collected by staff members, were not. And as people got increasingly drunk, and as commentators commented on, high, because there was a strong whiff of marijuana off the stands, discs were then just being thrown into the outfield like vicious decapitation frisbees. It was absolutely terrifying. The Tigers hitter, Rusty Staub, said the records would slice through the air and land sticking out of the ground. He was telling people when they were fielding to wear their batting helmets. And he said, it wasn't just one, it was many. Oh, God almighty, I've never seen anything so dangerous in my life. Attendees apparently also threw firecrackers, empty liquor bottles and lighters onto the field. And the game was stopped several times because of the rain of stuff that was being thrown down. It absolutely was. It was chaos already at that point. But then, obviously, you get the halftime period. Veek, by the way, this guy's still in charge of the thing. As the first game started and he heard of all the people outside the stadium, he sent security personnel to the gates to stop them. And so those security personnel were meant to be there stopping people throwing stuff onto the pitch. So he completely mismanaged the occasion by sending people to put out one fire while letting the other fire catch on even more. Dahl drove out onto the pitch, dressed in army fatigues and a helmet for this halftime thing. He said, this is now officially the world's largest anti-disco rally. Now listen, we took all the disco records you brought tonight, we got them in a giant box, and we're going to blow them up real good. And they did. And they massively damaged the field, so much so that the umpiring crew chief, Dave Phillips, said it was not playable, even after the groundskeeper spent an hour trying to tidy it up. It was not improved in any way, shape or form by 5,000 to 7,000 people from the crowd rushing out onto the field to dance around in the aftermath of the explosion.
I mean, it's got real sort of book burning vibes going on.
Yeah, absolutely does. Yeah. In fact, Nile Rodgers from Chic likened it to Nazi book burning. Gloria Gaynor, who sang I Will Survive, said, I've always believed it was an economic decision, an idea created by someone whose economic bottom line was being adversely affected by the popularity of disco music. So they got a mob mentality going. Some people have said it was basically the most extreme promotion in Major League Baseball history. And the riot police arrived at 9:08 p.m. in full riot gear to disperse the people remaining on the field. 39 people were arrested for disorderly conduct, and probably about 30 odd people were injured in the course of the event as well. The president of the American League, Lee MacPhail, postponed the second game until the following day. because the Tigers manager refused to allow his players to go back onto the pitch. Then the Tigers manager, Sparky Anderson, demanded that the game be forfeited. And he argued that under baseball's rules, a game can only be postponed by an act of God. And as the home team, the White Sox were responsible themselves for the field conditions. And McPhail, after some consideration, agreed with them. And the second game was forfeited to the Tigers 9-0. Rolling Stone critic Dave Marsh, it described the entire night as your most paranoid fantasy about where the ethnic cleansing of the rock radio could ultimately lead.
Oh, Jesus, that's a dystopian sentence.
It is very much one of the worst events in sporting history. And to be fair, there have been lots more of them we could have gone into. But that seems like a good one to finish on. So it seems wherever money and sport meet, there is the potential for calamity and chaos and isms of all sorts. So, well, we hope the European Super League remains dead and buried.
Yeah, keep sport poor, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we want.
Yeah. So, well, we can only hope salary caps are introduced. Speaking of salary caps, if you want to help Ben and I raise the ceiling of our earnings, and also if you want to help us keep making episodes like this, be like our patrons, go to patreon.com/worstfootforward and chuck us a few quid if you feel able to. And you will benefit from all sorts of benefits that they get, like extra monthly content and being able to suggest topics for episodes and be judges on episodes and all sorts of things.
Yeah, competitions and stuff like that we'd run from time to time. And if you do it, we promise, no matter how many of you contribute to the show, we won't run away and join the podcasting Super League.
Absolutely. We would be bottom of that league, but we would be guaranteed to be in it every bloody year. Thanks very much for listening to Worst Foot Forward, everybody. Goodbye.